Max Verstappen comfortably wins the first ever Miami Grand Prix to leave Charles Leclerc reliant on Ferrari's next upgrade package. This is the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is Round 5, the Miami Grand Prix. Powered by LeaveCal, keep track of employee leave and make resource planning easy. Search LeaveCal in the Zero App Store. The Miami Grand Prix was an extraordinary spectacle for a fairly ordinary race. Despite expectations for carnage around the unusually slippery street circuit, the Grand Prix was fairly tame and featured only one unusual crash. And that was just fine for Max Verstappen, who went into this race a little underdone after more car unreliability robbed him of practice time. Not that you'd have picked it from his race. A perfect start got him from 3rd to 2nd, past Carlos Sainz, and by lap 9 he was in the lead, past Charles Leclerc, undoing Ferrari's first front row start in almost 3 years. Red Bull Racing's pace on the medium tyre sealed the deal, with Ferrari again struggling to keep the softer rubber alive. And though they were better matched on the hards, the damage had already been done. Leclerc's better tyre warm-up added some jeopardy to a late-race safety car restart, but Verstappen had it all in hand, winning the race and cutting his championship deficit to just 19 points, down from 46 just 2 races ago. So to help dissect the first ever Miami Grand Prix, I'm joined by executive editor of GP Racing magazine, Stuart Codling. Codders, welcome back to the Strategy Report.
Good morning. Well, it's morning where I am. I'd say I can still taste the toothpaste, but I haven't got that far yet. I can still taste my morning coffee, which is a weird confection of cinnamon flavoured instant coffee and French vanilla creamer. So, where does it go from here? Evening where you are, isn't it? Good evening, Michael.
It is, thank you. Although, considering it's been such a long day for the time zone of Miami, it could be any time. Trying not to look out the window, it's easier that way generally. I've got to say, the first Miami Grand Prix, I guess there's two different ways you could cut it. Pretty good for a car park, average for a racetrack, would you agree?
Yeah, you're not wrong. And I think the drivers would agree with you. So, let's unpack the track first. An interesting layout. I think the drivers were broadly supportive of most of it. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to be invited at the last minute onto one of those Pirelli hot laps where you're driven around by drivers of varying competence at high speeds in cars of varying quality and appearance. I was very lucky. I was in a British Racing Green Aston Martin driven by Nico Hülkenberg, and next in line after me was none other than Hollywood one-note film director Michael Bay. So I half expected a graduated tint to appear in the sky and everything to break into slow-mo. So yeah, I got a taste of the circuit. There's a lot of it that's fast and flowing, a lot of what we might call connected corners, and maybe we could come back to those later, because they were a factor throughout qualifying especially, and the race, and in practice. And then in order to accommodate those sort of fast and flowing bits on the layout, it sort of loops, does a weird loop back underneath the access road to the nearby Florida Turnpike, and that's where we get to the kind of the Mickey Mouse chicane bit that the drivers hated. But I think they broadly liked the layout. They didn't like the chicane. They didn't like the corner that precedes the chicane where the wall is quite close, and so that's something that's going to be looked at for next year, and also the track surface itself. So what they did, the organisers, as well as landscaping the car park as best they could with AstroTurf and green paint and palm trees to make it not look like a Grand Prix in a car park. Let's not go into the business of the fake marina and beach resort. I don't mind them. You know, it's entirely in keeping with the general artifice of Miami. The track surface was a custom mix of some local aggregates, a lot of the stones from Georgia. So, you know, America's a big country. It's not that local. They had done their utmost. There was a lot of bitumen in the mix. And then they, after laying the surface, they had scraped it. So that the idea being that that would bring the bitumen up and provide an abrasive surface. And I think it's fair to say that has had mixed results. So it didn't deliver the grip expected or hoped for anywhere on the track, and it made for one line, which was relatively grippy, and then off that line, a lot of drivers said that it was like almost like racing in the wet. So you would, if you strayed off the line, either through making a mistake or, you know, heaven forfend, trying to overtake someone, then you would pick up all sorts of nonsense on your tyres, and that was you done for the rest of the lap, basically. And so we saw a little bit of that in the incidents through practice and qualifying. So that was a bit of a shame. I presume that they're going to lift it, and they'll just lay a new track surface next year. So there are what strange people in media and management call learnings, but we'll call lessons, because that's the actual word. And I think the other thing we should probably note is that the track surface was already beginning to peel in some crucial corners, even before a single Formula One car had taken to the track. They had to relay a couple of bits at turn seven after the Pirelli hot laps had been done, and then overnight into Saturday they relayed a few bits around turn 17, the final hairpin, and after the first running on Friday. And that was all starting to kick off when I went round with a couple of colleagues for a track run on Friday night. We were just arriving at turn seven when the track inspection team were there getting out their pickup truck, and one guy was going, "Well, you know, it's better than I thought." So they were quite impressed with the quality of repair there. And then they were just turning up because, you know, being older gentlemen, we don't run that fast. They were turning up with a truck to scrape and dump a load of new stuff on top of the final hairpin by the time we get there. So, yeah, there's been a touch of improv behind the scenes this weekend, it's fair to say, in order to deliver a spectacle.
Well, if the track started breaking up before the weekend even started, I suppose we can blame Michael Bay for that. It seems relatively in keeping with the style, I suppose.
Yeah, at least no one got blown up.
Well, that's a great positive, you know, great improvement on things then, really. Just as a brief aside to that, or addition to that, I thought it was interesting, as you mentioned there, it was sort of a custom kind of asphalt. They called it innovative. It was sort of a mixture of local kind of stuff. But it seems a little bit out of place, I suppose, in this era of Formula One, where it feels like every aspect of the sport is being interrogated for how well it supports the generation of overtaking and the spectacle and all that kind of stuff. But the literal track, in this case, was sort of a little bit of an experiment that just didn't seem to be pulled off.
Yeah, it to my mind, it says a lot about the power this Grand Prix holds and how important it is to Liberty Media and Formula One in general. They've coveted another race in America. They've been desperate to get this race across the line. Obviously, when first mooted, it was going to be downtown in Miami, but the local stakeholders, or, you know, depending on your political persuasion or affiliation, you might call them NIMBYs, saw that one off. So they ended up doing this deal with the Miami Dolphins stadium. And really, I mean, what an interesting deal that has been. We understand that, you know, they got it at a relative discount, sort of Monaco rates in terms of the amount of money changing hands between Formula One and the race promoter. And not only that, the race promoter was able to take at least the majority of the proceeds from a paddock club and hospitality. And haven't they just filled their boots? Because as you went round the circuit, there were a few grandstands, but most of it is corporate hospitality. And it's corporate hospitality that is right up against the circuit walls. So the much mocked marina and beach club, you really were looking over the circuit there. So it was a great VIP experience, but quite difficult in terms of the normal circuit architecture. You know, at a permanent racetrack, you have, you know, the circuit, the white line, the grass or asphalt, the tech pro wall, whatever that there, and then you have the sort of the inner or outer ring road where the marshals and photographers and whatever move around, and you can get the circuit vehicles that come round. That was actually not present for vast swathes of this circuit. So for the working people, that was quite difficult. Though the marshals Oh, fair play to them. It was a long working day for them because they had to be bussed out, actual coaches going out onto the circuit to drive them to their positions to drop them off. And they then had to stay there all day until nightfall or end close of play on track activities. And the coaches come round and pick them up. So an awful lot of normal working practices have been... no pun intended, thrown under the bus in order to secure a great VIP experience. And then I understand that there have been a few logistics problems in the local area, and I don't know what things are like in Australia. Certainly in where I live in the UK, there's been all sorts of mad, weird logistical problems affecting getting hold of food and stuff like that, and petrol at weird times. And there are lots of things in the local area. Even the Starbucks up the road has had to shutter its doors and do drive-through only because there's a shortage of the... Well, they've missed deliveries of their foodstuffs. So at the circuit on Saturday, they had to advise quite a few VIPs and corporate pass holders not to come because they weren't going to be able to cater for them. So that's sort of interesting in what it tells us about the times we live in. Mm. But also it poses a little bit of a, I won't say a dilemma because that's a choice between two equally disagreeable alternatives. It certainly poses a challenge for the promoters next year. That there's certainly no arguing that it was pretty much a success, this event, in terms of getting people through the door. But obviously these little bits of dysfunction behind the scenes may have an impact on uptake next year. You know, if someone has paid X thousand dollars to host a load of VIPs and they've been told they can't come, would they spend X thousand dollars next year? So year two of the Miami Grand Prix is going to be quite interesting, I think.
Absolutely. Look, give every VIP an F1 branded thermos and some instant noodles, and I'm sure that'll take care of at least part of the problem. Let's turn our attention to the race or the action on track in any case. You mentioned some of the specific aspects of the track. The first sector in particular, I think, was one of the better parts of the track, really. One of the more F1 typical bits of the track, I suppose. But it was also the one part of the track that it seemed like Ferrari was really performing quite strongly. The rest was a little bit more Red Bull territory. But it did take them some time to get up to speed, let's say, because for the practice sessions, they were quite difficult for Red Bull, particularly on the reliability front. This is an ongoing story over the course of the first five races, certainly, perhaps over more races still to come. Max Verstappen said that they're creating problems for themselves. In the end, of course, he won the race, so only so many problems, but he couldn't get pole position, for example. How costly is it to lose that kind of track time when we are talking about not only a new track, but what turned out to be quite a quirky track in terms of the characteristics to make the car work here?
Yeah, I suppose you can say in hindsight, knowing what we know now, that actually the net result was that Max won the race anyway. Mm-hmm. So you could say, well, it does him no harm. But actually, he had to fight to put himself in the position to win, and that in a car which should have been, it had the pace to be on pole position, and it was on balance over the course of a lap probably the slightly faster car compared with the Ferrari, and certainly it seems to be able to look after its tyres better over a long run, which also gives it a decisive advantage, as we saw at Imola as well. Mm-hmm. So these sort of little niggling problems with the car and the team kind of seeming to be struggling to get on top of them are costly. And, you know, as you said, on Friday, when Max suffered overheating in FP1, didn't get many laps in the tank, he was already starting to get a bit frustrated. The TV cameras obligingly pointed themselves into the Red Bull garage, and you saw people looking very animated, a bit stroppy. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that whatever was causing the overheating was something quite vexing, quite difficult to track down, probably relating to the tight packaging of the car. Adrian Newey, you know, pulling his beard stubble out And then losing FP2, they decided to have a gearbox change, and something went wrong there. When he finally got out, he struggled. There was something going on with his diff. He couldn't steer. They said it was a hydraulic problem, but then there was a fire around the right rear brake drum, so maybe something was rubbing. Maybe that was a factor of whatever was causing him to be unable to steer. So it just seemed like they weren't really on top of the car. And Max alluded to that after qualifying, where he said, you know, he was still learning his braking points and exploring the track to try and work out the best line through various places, or the best places to brake, and where to release the brake as well, where to accelerate. And it was while trying to do something a little bit different through turn five that he lost it a little bit in his final run on Q3, failed to improve on what had been the fastest time of that session, and both Leclerc and Sainz improved. So we had a Ferrari front row and Max a P3. So that gave him all the work to do in the race. And he did, not wanting to come back to this business of coaches going around the circuit again, but he did slightly throw the team under the bus when he said that we've make life difficult for ourselves.
And then it sets it up to make it look like he sort of saves the day in some respects, doesn't it? It did look relatively easy, though, in the race, didn't it? And this is an interesting aspect of things, I think, at the moment at least. After five rounds, the picture may indeed change when we get to the Spanish Grand Prix and there are more upgrades, particularly on the Ferrari side of things. But as you said, it seems like the Red Bull car's arrived in a place now where it had the quicker lap overall in it in this race. Certainly overtaking Charles Leclerc was relatively easy once he'd got past Carlos Sainz at the start. But it's that straight line speed, isn't it, that just seems to be kind of like the silver bullet for Red Bull at this point in time, because Ferrari hasn't really lost any of its pace through that medium and high speed stuff, has it? In fact, Leclerc's sector times were really, really impressive in qualifying and the race in the first sector, especially if you look at his telemetry and sort of throttle usage. But that straight line speed is just making such a massive difference. How much of that, as far as you're seeing, is engine versus aerodynamics? Is it something Ferrari can catch up on?
I think a lot of it is actually engine, and so probably there's not a great deal they can do. We've seen both here and in other circuits this year that at these really what you might call the VMAX areas of the circuit, these long straights, the different design choices that Ferrari and Honda have made really start to become apparent. So the Ferrari's hybrid system is configured to deliver a better whack at medium and low speed, so that really improves its cornering performance. That helps with the design choices they've made with the chassis. They've prioritized cornering performance. The Honda engine, they have more deployment available to the drivers on the straight. So when you reach a certain speed, the Honda in the Red Bull is able to deliver more acceleration, whereas the Ferrari, you know, encounters what the engineers call clipping, where it sounds like a car hitting the rev limiter as it kind of runs out of deployment, and you hear that in the in-car footage as it sort of goes it's a little bit like sports car correspondent Gary Watkins not knowing how to respond to a difficult question. It's a tricky, and I don't think they can design their way out of that in terms of the engine, because there's limited things you can do, and also they've baked that into the concept and it's worked well for them at certain places. What they have been trying to do, Ferrari, is play some tunes in terms of the aerodynamics. It was very interesting, the document the FIA now circulates at the beginning of the weekend as part of this business of the so-called show and tell that the teams have to do. They say what they've done to their cars. Red Bull said they've done nothing. Ferrari said that they had fitted it, and this is a lovely translation thing. They called it a depowered rear wing. So they went for a low drag rear wing in the hope that this would kind of ameliorate or mitigate the straight line speed deficit. And unfortunately, it's kind of clear that didn't really work out for them. So what you have to do as Ferrari, and as Charles Leclerc alluded after going on pole and flagged up the sort of the threat that Max still presented, he said that they need to stay ahead of the Red Bull, and to do that they need to make maximum gains through the corners, through the twistier sectors, in order to offset that advantage that the Red Bull then gains on the straights. And in doing that, they are taking more energy out of their tyres, and you saw that in the first stint, that just by managing his tyres better, Max was able to just sit and wait for the Ferrari to start showing signs of tyre degradation and then close to within DRS range and seal the deal with, as you said, kind of what looked like relative ease. But not to take anything away from Max, he at every point he did the right thing. He got the right start. He out-muscled Sainz into turn two. You know, he got alongside into turn one, having made marginally the better start. And then he sort of very forcefully said, turn two's mine. If you want to try and argue about it, you will be off the road somewhere. So take a ticket. And Sainz sort of thought, okay, right, well, I'll let you off the corner then. And that was very typical Max. So we saw the full spectrum of Max Verstappen in this race. The guy who can overtake very decisively and does the Senna style, let me through or we crash, but also the guy who can sit back and manage his tyres exquisitely while he waits for the perfect opportunity to do a clean overtake. So Ferrari, they'll be scratching their heads wondering how they deal with this combination of great car and a driver at the seemingly at the top of his form.
It's an interesting hypothetical, I suppose, to wonder whether if Carlos Sainz had been able to hold second place, how much that might have changed the complexion at the front. I'm reminded, completely different track, of course, but a good few years ago now, when Sebastian Vettel was leading Kimi Raikkonen and leading Lewis Hamilton in Hungary, and he had dodgy steering, but the fact that there were two cars to one managed to keep the faster car at bay. And I can't help but wonder whether this is an important moment for Carlos Sainz to have had that podium to clear his head a little bit and maybe reinsert himself into a championship fight, in which having two cars might actually be really important to Ferrari if the straight line speed disadvantage is just going to be a perpetual thing this year.
Yeah, I mean, you really do need both your drivers in the right place to run a blocking line. And I think Carlos did what he could. The poor bloke, he didn't see the finish in Australia or Imola, so as he said, he's lacking race fitness, and he also hurt his neck quite badly when he smote the wall, as Autosports Club legend Marcus Pye would say, during practice. It's tricky, isn't it? You do need both your drivers in the right place in order to play tunes on strategy, as Ferrari did all those years ago in Hungary. And we've seen it with Mercedes, with Red Bull as well, also in Hungary, and it went the other way, and Max was kind of able to be picked off by the Mercedes a couple of years ago when Pierre Gasly qualified somewhere in the Czech Republic, I think, on the grid, and was not there, leaving a huge gap for Mercedes to play strategic games. So it was actually quite interesting that after the race, there was another little pointed comment by Christian Horner about needing Sergio Perez to be play a bigger role in races in order to secure the world championship.
Which is
Although, yeah, that's quite mean, because you know, Sergio had an engine problem that the team didn't believe.
Yeah, yes, but then afterwards said that it was worth something like 20 kilowatts, which is an incredibly powerful sensor that failed.
Yeah, exactly. And they were arguing through the race. They were saying, no, there's nothing wrong. It's just you've lost the draft.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I can feel it. So that says a lot about where they see Perez in the pecking order, because if Verstappen said, I've got something wrong with my engine, then everyone would drop what they were doing to find what the problem was with the engine, because from Max's mouth, it's not a problem with lack of draft, it's definitely the engine, and they believe him. Whereas with Perez, they sort of think, well, you know, it's just his imagination. Get with the program. Just drive faster. In the words of Sir Patrick Head to Antonio Pizzonia, whatever it is that you do, do it better.
A good summary, indeed. Towards the end of the race, we got a little bit more excitement when we saw Ferrari's better tyre warm-up after the safety car help Leclerc have a second go at Verstappen, essentially on the same tyre. On the hard tyre, the Ferrari was a much better match for the Red Bull racing car, but not enough to overcome that straight-line speed advantage, and Verstappen managed to secure the victory. And Carlos Sainz managed to stay ahead of Sergio Perez. I guess both of them a little bit compromised. Sainz had had a slow stop, but that time lost to a sensor problem meant Perez was not close enough to capitalize. And he had a go, but could not get it done on new medium tyres. One of the few drivers in the field who had fresh tyres to switch onto behind that safety car. I want to talk a little bit about Mercedes before we wrap this one up, though, because George Russell, again, quite a big winner from hanging around waiting for a safety car, managed to make a big gain in the end, finishing ahead of Hamilton and even Valtteri Bottas. But I was surprised so few drivers risked a similar strategy, a long run to open the race, considering that while we had a relatively tame race in the end, only really one crash, one intervention, the slippery track, the closeness of the walls, we'd seen plenty of crashes throughout practice. We surprised more drivers, more teams weren't banking on that being the situation in the race and going for a similar strategy.
Yeah, I was reminded a little bit of the inaugural Azerbaijan Grand Prix, the European Grand Prix, as it was peculiarly known back then, where in effect, the drivers all were sitting idly or hiding in their hospitality suites, watching the GP2 race, as F2 was known then, and just watched the almighty lunacy and incompetence that ensued at turn one. Every time there were shunts, then there'd be a safety car, then there'd be a restart, then there'd be a shunt at the restart, and collectively they all shook their heads and thought, let's not do that. And the result was quite a tame and dull race, and everyone hit the emergency button and said, well, this track's no good, it's useless, we shouldn't come here again. And well, we haven't we had a lot of exciting races at that track ever since? So as people kind of got over that fear and learned a bit more about it. And so much of Sunday's race in Miami was dictated by this kind of queasiness about what lay in store if you stepped off the racing line. And when even that change of position for the lead, there were a lot of people who said that Leclerc capitulated at turn one to Verstappen, as sort of Verstappen got alongside and kind of went around the outside. And Leclerc sort of stuck to his guns, didn't block, stayed on the racing line. And Leclerc said after the race, I did that because I thought that was the best option. I wasn't capitulating. I just thought all my experience of that part of the track off the line in that space through Friday and Saturday was that the grip was a disaster. So I thought my best option is to occupy the racing line and stick to what I know and optimize my braking. So you can see why starting on the hard tire, which offered not great warm-up compared with the medium tire, that was very much the outlier strategy and one picked on or alighted upon by people who were, let's say, out of position further down the grid from where they should have been and who had less to lose. And if you look at the way Russell's race panned out, he did lose positions at the start and then the race came back to him. So it's very easy to say in hindsight that that was the right thing to do, but if had any other circumstances eventuated, it might have been different. But what we can say is that those hard tyres really did last very well, and George managed them beautifully. You know, even when he was sort of coming up with that radio message to the team saying, you know, we can just stay on these tyres and hope for a safety car, that spoke a lot about his confidence in it at that point. And the lap times he was doing, he was in the 1 minute 33s, which was what the leading group were doing. So he wasn't, it's not as if those tyres were losing performance and that he was desperate to get off them, as some people had been on the mediums earlier. He was quite, he could have done umpteen more laps and wait. He could have waited until a safety car, 5 laps from the end, maybe. Who knows? So that was certainly interesting, but it's something that's very easy to judge in hindsight and probably wasn't the right choice if you were fighting for a podium spot.
And it's an interesting contrast as well. Admittedly, only a small slice of everything that happened in Lewis Hamilton's race, for example, but he was seemed a little bit frustrated, a little bit flustered to be given the option behind the safety car of whether or not to pit. He said afterwards that he wanted to rely on the team's overall view of the situation of the race in making that decision. In the end, he didn't really have any other tyres to switch to anyway, only a new set of hards, and the warm-up on those were quite difficult, so it's debatable whether it would have been worthwhile or not, even though he probably would have only lost one position to George Russell, which he lost anyway. How have you seen this phase of Lewis Hamilton, I suppose? Obviously, it's been pretty overblown the last couple of rounds, this idea that he's lost his edge or he's been beaten by Russell. But this is a different kind of problem solving required of him now compared to when it was only a matter of finding those extra tenths in the last couple of seasons to win races against whoever it was he was racing. Now, there's a lot out of his hands at the moment, is there, in terms of extracting the ultimate performance from the car?
Yeah, the car is very tricky. Capricious. He's likened it to a venomous snake, and I don't buy this theory that Lewis has lost it. Everything about his demeanor when I see him, he's the same Lewis. He's the same incredibly competitive animal, and you just know that behind the scenes he is directing all his energy into being the best driver he can be and in spurring the team on to find a way to unlock what they believe is the latent performance in that car. What we've seen where in the past few races where Lewis is perceived to have been underperforming relative to Russell, there have always been reasons for it. For instance, at Imola, he started on the wet line, which all the people who started on that line had problems. He wasn't the only one. And the people who started on the dry line benefited. And he was similarly a victim of circumstance in this race. He just had the different strategy, so that the timing of the safety car left him with a choice between definitely being overtaken by his teammate and maybe likely being overtaken by his teammate. And he opted to take the choice that gave him a little bit of a chance to make sure that didn't happen. So I think he made the right decision. I was a little bit surprised that his discussion with the team took the form of, well, you tell me, man, what do we do? He's usually a little bit more proactive, so I think maybe he was slightly demoralized at the time. So he's a driver who wears the heart on his sleeve, really, isn't he, Lewis? So when things aren't going his way, you can feel that sense of disappointment and annoyance, and you can sense that he's sort of pouting a little bit under his crash helmet, and you sort of think, come on, you know, you're a 7-time world champion, you can do this. So it's an interesting human story for sure, but I don't think we've seen the last of Lewis yet, and he's no less committed. Likewise, I think George has bagged every single opportunity he has, and it was a great race by him to make up for what had been a bit of a trouble qualifying, which I think the qualifying performance of Mercedes in this Grand Prix tells you everything you need to know about where that car is right now, if they're still struggling to understand it.
And just finally, before we wrap this one up, there were several different strategy plays through the field. One that I thought was a little bit interesting, and I think that is probably illustrative of where the car was during this Grand Prix, was McLaren. This was, as Lando Norris described it, a bit of a reality check for the team after a couple of good races. Lando Norris ran sort of the conventional strategy, I suppose, was probably on for 1 or 2 points. Daniel Ricciardo was left out on his opening set of mediums till lap 30, the longest medium stint of the race. His times were not spectacular, but they were consistent. You know, it's obviously, this is a hindsight situation. 10 more laps, he would have got to the safety car. It's hard to know how much further those mediums could have gone, though. But it really struck me as one of those strategies you see where a team knows the car's not really that good for much in a race where overtaking was a little bit difficult, and they just ended up in a real nowhere land, a no man's land, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And they got kind of snookered by the safety car after that, didn't they? And like you say, it does bespeak a team that's having to reach for solutions. And just flicking through my notebook now, there's an asterisk and three exclamation marks by my note that Ricardo came in at lap 30. So that was one I'd kind of marked for future investigation, to thump a table and demand to know why. So the unfortunately I didn't get to the McLaren post-race pressers, so those audio excuse notes are still in my my inbox. So I'm looking forward to hearing the rationale behind that. But like you say, it does speak to a certain desperation, maybe not, because their chief strategist is a smart guy. I don't think he does things in desperation, Randy Singh. I think he always has a reason, and he has a vision, and sometimes it pays off, sometimes it doesn't, and he understands the risks. He knows. He once said to me that a bad strategy is a bad strategy, even if it accidentally turns out well. If you made a decision that was not good, and that was a gamble, and circumstances mean it worked, it was still a terrible decision, and you just got away with it. So yeah, they were unfortunately a little bit snookered by the safety car. And then, you know, Daniel came in again for a swap to soft tyres, which indicates that they thought that was the best course of action. And just, you know, where was he when he came in? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15th place when the safety car was running and after it stopped. So, you know, net, they didn't lose too much in terms of track position, and the idea was to roll the dice with soft tyres at the end and see what happened. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who did swap to much softer rubber at the end when it was available, it didn't really come off for them, or it didn't generate the advantage that you would have expected. Even Ocon, who finished in the top 10 for Alpine, also having started at the back, also made slightly heavy weather of that last stint. There was a bit of agitated radio traffic between him and the team, them saying you basically need to run a blocking line for Alonso to enable him to overcome the 5-second penalty he had and not lose position. And Ocon saying, if I do that, I'll get overtaken. I can't do that. So I think maybe the last minute swap to soft rubber was a decision that wasn't borne out by what happened. And then, of course, Daniel was deemed to have gone off the track and gained an advantage, so he was also penalised after the race. What was interesting about Daniel after the race was he was in Smiley Dan mode and not I'm going to punch a hole in the wall mode. So I think, judging by that, he kind of thought that was about the best they were expecting to get from that race, which disappointing, but the fact that he was quite sort of sanguine about it and he seemed to be relatively happy with his own performance, I think, you know, you can take a lot from that. It's just going to be another year where the McLaren technical package is strong in some places and less strong in others, which is kind of weird considering it's a completely different car, that it should seem to have some of the same quirks as its predecessor.
It is interesting, isn't it? Same people designing it, it's a lot of different people designing it, but the same group, and you do end up with something that does resemble cars of the past. It's an interesting thing. The Miami Grand Prix finally got off the ground. Didn't look much like a car park, although I'd be fascinated to see it in a couple of weeks when it does return to its native state as a resting place for cars going to the football.
But it's probably halfway there now. They were starting to pull it apart as we left.
Yeah, it's very impressive, isn't it? An interesting race, five races in. Can't wait to see what happens next in this championship. Stuart, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I know it's always a risk that I might say something borderline lunatic, especially when I'm only one coffee into the day.
Defeat in Miami was no disaster for Ferrari, but every step forward Red Bull Racing has taken in the last few rounds has ratcheted up the pressure for Maranello's first big upgrade package to deliver at the upcoming Spanish Grand Prix. The car should already be suited to Spain and Monaco as it is, so victory there will be crucial to the Italian team's title credentials. Thanks very much to Stuart Codling for joining me. The Strategy Report is powered by LeafCal, Keep track of employee leave and make resource planning easy. Search Leave Cal in the Xero App Store. You can subscribe to the Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a rating and a review to help spread the word. You can also find us on social media. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Loke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Amanato, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks to debrief the Spanish Grand Prix.